Welcome to episode 6 of the Anarchist Book Club with Jim Yeoman and me, Danny Evans. For this edition, we had the privilege of being joined by Constance Bontemps to talk about her forthcoming book, Jean Grave and the Networks of French Anarchism. Constance is the author of The French Anarchists in London, 1880 to 1914, and the co-editor of the important collections New Perspectives on Anarchism, Labour and Syndicalism with Dave Berry and Reassessing the Transnational Turn with Bert Altena. Constance has been an inspiration to Jim and myself, and we are chuffed that she agreed to be the first guest on the podcast. We hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to the podcast, Constance. We're really delighted to have you here as our first interviewee. We're going to talk today about your forthcoming book, Jean Grave and the Networks of French Anarchism, which is scheduled to be published in 2021. Just to start things off very broadly and basically, who was Grave and why did you want to write a book about him?
Okay, well, first of all, thank you very, very much for having me to discuss this. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. So Grave was one of the most influential French anarchist communist figures in the pre-1914 French and international anarchist movement. He was a journalist, an editor, a writer, playwright, novelist, theorist, campaigner, and educator. And I'm probably forgetting a few other definitions. He was born in 1854, died in 1939, and was politically active pretty much for his whole life once he started a militancy from the, say, mid 1870s onwards. And he was most noted amongst all the things that he did for his journalism, for running three highly influential papers, Le Révolté, which lasted from the late 1870s to the mid 1880s, followed by La Révolte, mid 1880s until the mid 1890s, and then Le Révolté, which started in 1895 and was discontinued when the war broke out in 1914. That's Grave, broadly speaking, very influential figure. And the main reason why I wanted to write about him, there's a double rationale. Which the first one is a sort of personal interest in Grave. I did a lot of work on Franco-British anarchist connection in the same period, what is known as the heroic period of anarchism between 1880 and 1914. And this was a time of intense exile and exilic activity. And Grave didn't really leave Paris throughout this period, but he was always there in the background, especially because he had this strong connection with Peter Kropotkin, who was based in London throughout most of this period, well, London and the southeast of England, and set up Freedom, which was closely partnered with Grave's periodicals. So Grave was always there, and it's an absolutely fascinating figure, not a very well-liked figure, well-known or rather notorious for his very foul temper, his very uncompromising stance, his orthodox approach to anarchism, and at the same time, someone who was exceptionally well connected and absolutely adored by very interesting figures. So, for instance, artists, intellectuals, other anarchists, starting with Kropotkin. So I was quite drawn to that. And the second aspect, and the more theoretical one, was what Grave has to teach us, so to speak, about transnationalism, which I'm really interested in, the anarchist transnationalism. The fact that Grave precisely never really left Paris in this time of incredible anarchist mobility and yet wielded this global influence. There was a deep paradox there that I thought was really interesting because it presented the opportunity to study transnationalism outside the usual framework of personal mobility.
Constance, in the work that you've already published on Jean Grave, you talk about taking a relational approach to his life. Is that an approach that forms the book? Perhaps you could expand on what the relational approach is and what the key sort of relationships you think are fundamental to understanding Grave's biography?
Yes, so I used that concept in an early article I published, and this was borrowed from social movement theory. It's this idea that militants and movements are shaped through the relationships between their activists, and that it applied really well to Graf because of the fact that he wrote so much about the value of connecting, associating, forming links. So it seemed to work really well for Graf, and it was also an attempt to move on from the concept of networks, which has been so extensively used for the historiography of this period, and especially by me, I think. And it worked well, but I actually haven't used it that much for the book. I'm back to networks. I find that somehow it was a slightly narrow framework. There's no denying that anarchism was hugely relational, but I've actually used other concepts more. So back to networks, which is, I think, a very flawed actually concept, but it still works. But also sociability, I found, worked better for Graf. To answer the second part of your question, I think it's a very good question. The key circles and sets of relations that are important to set out from the start to understand Graf. So I would say there are probably four or five important circles. The first one is really his core connections with the historical leaders of anarchist communism, many of whom were connected with the First International, the legacy of the Commune. So this would be, of course, Kropotkin, Élisée Reclus, Tcherkasov, Max Nettler, who, of course, was not involved in the Commune, but one of those historical international militants. Jacques Gross, his archives is at Amsterdam Institute, Tcherkasov, so these big international figures. The second circle would be the paper team, the various groups he worked with. So Paul Delsalle, who was a French anarchist and syndicalist who worked with Graf in his paper for a long time, Girard, there are other sort of context, and all the people who collaborated to the papers more or less durably at one point or another. Third really, really important circle is the sort of wider human rights progressive circles that were associated with anarchism at one point or another, usually in the context of human rights progressive campaigns in this period in France and abroad. So on top of my head, Francis de Pressensé, who was a human rights lawyer, Anatole France, who was connected with the Ligue des Droits de l'Homme, an important human rights oriented organization, but also internationally, Federico Morales, who connected with Graf in the context of the Spanish atrocities campaign. So really important to understand Graf's influence beyond anarchism. Fourth circle, essential and a really appealing one, all of Graf's artistic and literary connections. He had all these links with really influential neo-impressionist artists, symbolist writers. He printed their art in his papers. They really supported his propaganda and really broadened the appeal of anarchism. And lastly, his second wife, Mabel Holland Thomas, later Graf. He married her in 1909, and really interesting because one of his very few female connections, but also a close partner for him. They had this really interesting militant partnership. So I think that story needs to be reclaimed.
That was a really good sense of the kind of the many layers of circles and networks that Graf was very much a part of. And everything you've said so far like chimes really strongly with, you know, with the work that I've done as well. And it's interesting you mention Federico Rales, because, you know, so much of the way that you've depicted Graf sounds very similar, you know, to how I view Rales. And in my own work as well, this question of how we study anarchism by looking at individuals and what that brings and the things that we gain from that. But then also it chimes with my own reluctance to want to concentrate on individuals who might be seen as exceptional, this image of a kind of anarchist running around different continents. And I've always been quite skeptical about, you know, how representative those figures are. And I think this idea of Graf as being a node, you know, an individual within many layers, and yet himself being quite sedentary, staying in Paris, I think is a really fascinating way that inverts that typical way of looking at anarchist individuals as a part of the wider movement. Do you think these people like Graf, these sedentary yet transnational figures, are in fact more normal or representative of anarchism at this moment than the more buccaneering, city-hopping figures that are quite common to studies of the turn of the century movements?
That's a very interesting question. So I was looking at notes I'd made on this, and I had Spanish anarchist question mark, Jim. So see, I was ready to return the question to you. But I think that's because your work brings print into the equation. And I think it's only quite recently, while it's always been there in the background, that print has been brought back into this whole equation and adding a further dimension of mobility. Traditionally, it's been sedentary anarchists, or national anarchists, if you like, and then these wandering, globe-trotting militants, also a labor migration, which is far more prominent in the historiography, probably of the Hispanic movement. So print has, I think, really changed our understanding of that, and thanks to your work in large part. But in terms of being representative and other sedentary yet transnational figures, it's an interesting one. I think it's difficult to talk of a typical anarchist, actually, and find out an ideal type, because mobility was so prominent. I would say that, generally speaking, it's probably useful to try and think more finely about the interplay of mobility and sedentariness or rootedness. So, for instance, if you take the example of Émile Pouget, who was probably a more French militant than Grave, but Pouget went into exile in London. He stayed there for quite some time, sort of imported back syndicalism into France based on the model of trade unionism, then went on to become the general secretary of the CGT. And somehow he retained a more French outlook, I think, in his activism. A more sort of traditionally French or exclusively French figure would be Sébastien Faure, who edited Le Libertaire and was, you know, perhaps a sort of rival figure to Grave. And again, was very, very French in his outlook. He had some international influence. So it's difficult to find a sort of single model. Last example I had in mind was the thriving French community of anarchists or French speaking in Pennsylvania. And this was really linked to labor migration. So we have a completely different model there. I think that there are more of these figures than we think, but there's no sort of unique type. And I think we have different types of mobilities and rootedness at play. And it's definitely worth exploring further.
Some of the more recent work that's taken place in terms of looking at transnational anarchism has raised like quibbles, I suppose, with any kind of easy correspondence between the mobility of anarchists in that heroic period and anarchist internationalism. One of the ways in which that has been done is by looking precisely at these more sedentary anarchists who nevertheless cultivated a cosmopolitan or internationalist political practice and outlook. But I think that might be interrogated a bit more deeply, you know, the counterposing of rootedness to, you know, the roots, R-O-U-T-E-S, of mobile anarchism, I think raises some questions about what it means to be attached to place, and particularly in a, you know, the high point of imperialism and the projects to nationalize citizenships, populations of any given territory, particularly in Western Europe, I think has some troubling implications that you have looked at in some of your work on this period already. I don't know if perhaps we could talk about how this applies in the case of Grave, you know, somebody who's obviously connected to not just an internationalist milieu, but also to specific French artistic movements. He's based in the capital as well. And what sort of implications that might have for the way he practiced anarchism, as opposed to somebody who I know you've worked on a lot as well, like Louise Michel, whose internationalism did seem to overlap with her highly mobile biography.
About five questions in one, but I'll try to address the various aspects. I think the one that you raised at the beginning, which is absolutely fundamental, is the importance of imperialism and the fact that Grave lived in an imperial metropolis. And this is such a blind spot in the historiography of the French movement. That's one aspect which I was actually quite pleasantly surprised by. When I started this, I absolutely assumed that I was going to find some very backward views, some hegemonic assumptions on Jacques' part, and it's absolutely not the case, actually. He was, I think, as enlightened as one might be for an anarchist in this period. Fairly early anti-colonial consciousness. Actually, Ole Berk Lawson has shown his work that Jacques actually was pretty much at the cutting edge of, say, anarchist writing on colonial matters, and he did write several early works that were quite modern in their outlook, whilst being also limited in terms of assuming the superiority, say, of the colonizing country. Sorry, but that's a bit of a digression from your main question. Maybe we can come back to this, but I think it's an important one. And there's also, of course, the whole Third Republic perspective, peasants into Frenchmen, as the famous book goes, and this idea of nationalizing the nation. And Jacques really tried to address this as well. That's where his educational work sort of came in, very much aligned, say, with Ferrer and all these attempts to fight nationalistic indoctrination through alternative pedagogical works. In terms of being rooted in a place, you cite the example of Michel, which of course is interesting because Michel had such a cosmopolitan and global consciousness. She was absolutely the exception, I think, and she was so sincere wherever she went. She engaged in such a sincere way. Of course, she died in 1905, so it's difficult to know where she would have stood in 1914 when, crunch time came and they had to make a decision. So Grave famously made the wrong decision, so to speak. He co-wrote the Manifesto of the 16 with Kropotkin, so sided with the defences, or articulated very much the anarchist defensist argument in favour of the war to protect France from German invasion. But Grave's position has been very much assimilated with Kropotkin's, and that's one of the things I found as well whilst researching the book, is that actually he came to this through a far more complex and gradual journey than Kropotkin. So he was not a nationalist. There was nothing. Well, Kropotkin wasn't a nationalist either, but it's more complex than that. And I think he did generally have a deeply international consciousness throughout. So it's really, really tainted everything that was his downfall. And he absolutely never recovered from this. If you read his obituaries in 1939, he was very much de facto expelled from anarchism for advocating support for the war, backing down on his earlier internationalism, anti-militarism. So what has been interesting for me in researching that specific section of the book has been to discover what a gradual process this was, in fact. And Grave starts off the war, not with a hugely enlightened position, but in the beginning, his very much in line with his earlier practice, his main focus is to organize a progressive coalition against the war, sort of calling on all his partners nationally and internationally from, say, the Spanish atrocities, their air mobilization to try and influence public opinion. So that fell completely flat. Nobody replied, or people told him, well, the war was going to last for a really long time. Now is not the time. I think he was under very blinkered illusion that the war would be short-lived. It would be just a matter of months. And it was only very gradually that he came round to Kropotkin's position. There's a very famous letter from Kropotkin really telling of Grave for nursing this illusion that war was going to be short and anything could be done against him. I think Kropotkin's letter literally says, "My heart melted," or something really poignant like this, "when I read your letter, to see that you live in this world of illusion." And it was a very slow process. So Grave at that stage was actually in the UK, well, in Britain. He went to England and to Wales to live with his brother and sister-in-law. And he was really interested in the militancy of a group known as the Union for Democratic Control, the UDC, which is an anti-war but very parliamentary-oriented organization, which tried to organize for a more citizen-led approach to pacifist militancy. And he was really interested in that. So it's always the same idea: organize, spread progressive views, fight nationalism through press campaign, but that fell completely flat. And he really tried to do this for a long time. And what tilted him over was he had a few sort of quite vicious arguments, and in particular about the ownership of his paper, Les Temps Nouveaux, which was still more or less running in Paris, but run by another group or sort of other editors. And they had a really bitter argument. And I think that was the last straw for him. So that, the argument from Kropotkin, the realization that the war was not going to finish so quickly, that it took such a toll. And that's how, sort of towards the end of 1915, early 1916, that's where he really came round to Kropotkin's view and co-drafted the Manifesto of the 16 with him, which set out the pro-war argument. Once he did that, there was no going back. He defended that view, and he defended it until his death.
Coming back to this question then, of is it the case that it's difficult to perceive any ideological antecedents that can explain his turn, other than his very strong relationship to Kropotkin, perhaps and a growing sense of fatalism about the war as it obviously persisted longer than he'd originally anticipated? From what you've said, he seems to have been very wedded to the possibilities of a progressive alliance based around ideas of, you know, republican ideas of universal human rights and so forth. It does seem like that overlaps with the kind of arguments that were made in favor of opposing German militarism. Is that something that perhaps provides a clue into understanding his apparent about face?
Yes, up to a point, I think, tend to think that there was the sort of human rights argument, republican or universalist perspective, but that way just as much as, I think, say, the relational network consideration, the collapse of his Temps Nouveaux family, the really bitter quarrel, Kropotkin sort of pressure, and his realization that indeed the war was there and that there was a very real threat. He responded very strongly to the violence unfolding in Belgium and the bloodbaths. I think that alerted him somehow to what he perceived to be the absolute threat of German militarism, and perhaps winning him over to the arguments articulated since 1905 by Kropotkin about the national defense of France. But it seems to me that it was less Franco-centric than Kropotkin's view in that case. And the last element to add, which is relational again, is his in-laws and the milieu he was in whilst in Britain. He was in these upper class circles. His in-laws were incredibly well connected. His wife had been to boarding school. They were a family of artists with links to the Liverpool shipping industry. His brother-in-law was a very famous doctor and medical academic. His brother-in-law was also the executor of the will of Napoleon III. He speaks incredibly candidly in his memoir about being put in these circles where his family and relatives had friends and family in both the British and the German army. So there's something to be said about the breakdown of networks and being transplanted into a completely different environment. And I think that also must have acted in some way in making him change his mind and effectively lose some of his radical edge and internationalism.
Just to stay on this moment, 1914 as well, the parallels with what's going on in Spain are really, really clear. You know, I think that your centering of grabbing this relational approach really applies also in Spain, because there you have this division similar to, you know, to everywhere else in Europe and the world at the time, between anarchists, those who are supporting the Entente and the war effort, and the Manifesto of the 16, who are the minority, depict themselves primarily as Francophiles, as people who have direct contact with Kropotkin and Grave, people like Federico Rales, people like Ricardo Meyer, these people who have spent decades in constant communication with papers like Les Temps Nouveaux and Freedom in London. There is something in that. I think that it's very much these networks and relationships kind of form across borders and actually kind of fracture the national attitudes, which in Spain, you know, the majority, the kind of the young CNT takes a very aggressively anti-war stance, but that tends to be younger militants, militants who haven't been in these kind of late 19th century networks. This example of Grave, I think, does extend out, you know, all across Europe at this very kind of critical moment. And I wonder as well if it's, you know, I'm always kind of hesitant about generational analysis, but it does feel something along those lines is happening at around this moment, that there is a shift. And as you say, Grave seems to be out of that kind of environment now in Britain, in Spain. Mayen Urrales are increasingly ostracized from the movement. And I wonder if this is a shift in which networks are the predominant ones in the international anarchist kind of scene.
Yes, and it's such a watershed moment. And that's why it's also so interesting to study the post 1918 period, which is overwhelmingly looked at as a period of decline, marginalization. And it's really interesting to see what happens when there's a loss of influence and networks dissolved or reconfigured, and there's a real change in the balance of power. And you mentioned Urrales, and it's such an interesting example because I was so marginalized after 1918, but one person he remained in contact with, but still managed to argue with, was Urrales. And so enduring networks consolidated through the Manifesto of the 16, or the pro-Entente position. But as you say, the Manifesto, it really seals a generational breakdown in terms of age, but also exposure to syndicalism. There are other factors. There's also, that was pointed out by Metron, the towering historian of the French movement, the legacy of the Commune that played into the generational factor, having had contact with that historical moment, but also this historical generation of militants. What I've found looking more closely at it, I think there is an element, a geographical element, if you look at the global movement, that the Manifesto was very French and Francophone, as you say. A lot of the signatories were Belgian, Swiss, but also Spanish or Italian anarchists connected with the French movement, whereas the opposite position, of course, which was led by Malatesta, had a lot of traction in the US as well. So I think that we can try and think about the geographic dimension. And lastly, and it's why also it's interesting to write biographies, there is the personal element, how friendships might have impacted, how people might have been won over to one position or the other. So, for instance, looking at Grave's correspondence, it appears that he was really reluctant to ask Charles Malato to sign it. Malato was a hugely influential anarchist, communist, transnational activist. He has gone down in history as one of the key signatories of the Manifesto, and Grave found him too nationalistic, so he didn't want to ask him, but in the end he did. And similarly, there are a few cases and names that do crop up that actually ended up in the opposite camp one way or another. So there's still other factors at play.
Yeah, this is so interesting, and it raises so many different possible questions. Going off your last point about the importance of friendships and these individual personal relationships, are we identifying a possible weakness within the network model? It seems like to me that some of the historiography on this, on the question of anarchist networks, has tended to emphasize the strengths of the network as a way of the anarchist movement persisting in spite of state repression and so forth. There are multiple different possible benefits of networks, I would have thought, within social movements. But do they tend to privilege like the importance of like certain key influential individuals that perhaps has the potential to weaken the resolve of other members of these networks who potentially have more consistent politics?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the things that does appear. I was, when I started charting one of Grave's networks, I was really expecting to find a lot of movement and diversity, which I did find. And of course, you have to be pragmatic while trying to make sense out of it. But networks are actually quite rigid over time. You're right. And it's very much, especially, say, the Grave's Hispanic connection in Spain, but across Latin America, it tends to be quite constant and repetitive with small variation. So it does emphasize the importance of individuals. And that's one of the reproaches I've come across in recent scholarship, which I thought was interesting, saying it's still, if you think about it, it's still a very top-down, elite-led approach. If you read a report from an Argentinian group in Le Temps Nouveau, week after week, you can say that's amazing, because that's actually first-hand information reporting on an actual local group, and it's a live exchange. You know, it's not somebody who has read an Argentinian paper and is reporting back and translating it. That's a lively network, but at the same time, it doesn't tell you about the actual life of the group. It's still an elite reading of it by a multilingual militant. So that's one limitation. But the other aspect, and why I do have misgivings about using this, and I'm very aware of all the objections about against the qualitative use of networks and that it's unscientific. I don't do data visualization, tracking networks over time. So it's a very unscientific approach, and I'm already expecting some critiques on this point. But what I found really interesting, again, charting this post-war period, is looking at networks as being strong, lively, shifting, but also what happens to networks in times of crisis. So redeployment, how the post-1918 networks remodeled, reshaped earlier alliances with elements of both continuity and rupture. So ideas of reconfiguration and dissolution as well. So when does a network cease to be a network and just becomes really an individual connection? Because you can have really small effective networks of, say, two people, Graf or Alice. That's a very, they're both relayed in their respective communities. But when they both lose influence, it ceases to be a network.
It kind of goes the other way as well at times. You know, the network can kind of devolve down into these individual relationships, but also the networks can feed up in a sense and almost become institutions. What I find in Spain, the newspapers edited by Orales, there are hundreds of anarchist papers published in Spain at this point, but the ones that are published by Orales become almost the institution of the movement prior to any kind of formal institution existing. And I think you're absolutely right to kind of point out these networks clearly existed, but I think there's a difference between, and I think you do this very well in lots of your work, there's a difference between identifying that this is a form that is clear, you know, amongst anarchist movements across the world at this point. The difference between that and then suggesting that this is a wonderful model or this is the way to organize, because anarchists themselves at the time were aware of the shortcomings of this loose networked kind of organization. And they're constantly trying to navigate between how much should we rely on this? How much should we have some kind of formalization of these networks? The dangers of promotion of individuals at this point. Even just 10 years ago, when we look at the Arab Spring, for example, you know, people talk about how it's great that this networked movement of Twitter put all these people together as if like that's enough to have a network is the end point. I don't think the actors that we're looking at the time felt that it was sufficient. It's just a way of doing it.
Absolutely. And actually, that's one point where Graf changed his mind after the war. That was his main mea culpa after the war, was that he had always promoted free association, which was very much the preference across anarchist circles, and that he hadn't pushed more for organization into an anarchist federation. But of course, we know all the objections there were to such centralism and authoritarian approach. So it is interesting when it solidifies, as it did in syndicalism. Of course, it resonates massively with current activism, Arab Spring, alter globalization, Black Lives Matter. But actually, if there is something to learn from the anarchist lesson of this period, is that network activism, it's a useful heuristic tool, but it's important not to look down at organizational efforts.
Since you mentioned syndicalism, perhaps you could reflect on Jean Grave's attitude to revolutionary syndicalism in this period, to the CGT and so forth. He's obviously interested in, like, as you mentioned, these like progressive liberal alliances, the potential of those kinds of networks. What was his attitude to, you know, the working class as the kind of agent of bringing about the anarchist communist society he believed in?
He was on the side of Netlau. Max Netlau articulated the anti-syndicalist argument because he saw syndicalism as being very reductive, this idea of cells of producers, self-managed producers, forming the basic cell of future society. Glav echoed that. He wrote quite a lot on syndicalism as being very restrictive as compared with anarchism, which was far broader, cultural, philosophical, lifestyle endeavor. He was certainly criticized for this, but at the same time, he actually had a standing column in Le Temps Nouveau run by syndicalists. They often left because he was so difficult to work with, but he did engage in a dialogue with this. Let's say it's possibly, retrospectively, not one of his most progressive stances.
Perhaps for listeners who might not be as au fait with Grav's biography, we have a clear idea of where he stood on CGT. Perhaps we could have a clear idea of where he stood in relation to perhaps one of the other key shaping phenomena of the period in France and the Dreyfus Affair.
Yes, again, not one of his finest moments, but it's really interesting. Sorry, his Dreyfus activism, because Grav was really an amazing campaigner. And that's where, again, relational activism comes in, because he really had this vision of what a campaign was like. Grav was a dismal public orator, and he was really shy. He had a stutter, and he never wanted to speak in public, but he had a very clear idea of how to run a campaign through print. And he did it repeatedly. The Spanish atrocities, a number of campaigns in France, and Le Temps Nouveau was really the go-to place for campaigning as part of broader coalition. He did a lot of this, fundraising, transnational connections, absolutely amazing. And Grav himself was actually the beneficiary of a campaign in 1894 when he ended up in prison in the context of the mass anti-anarchist repression under the wicked laws at the time of the first wave in France. And there was a great deal of mobilization in Grav's favor, with, again, intellectuals from outside anarchism and artists testifying in his favor, writing in the press. And this has been analyzed as a forerunner of the birth of the intellectual that is traditionally associated with the Dreyfus Affair. So you would think that Grav would have been a natural Dreyfusard, but no. So like many anarchists, initially he was really put off, you know, why would we defend a military figure, Jewish at that, you know, all the cliches you can expect. And even when the tide turned, it took him quite a while to rally around. His argument, he had a manifold argument. He always remained a bit reluctant. He was not opposed ultimately, but he was really reluctant. So his argument was that there remained many anarchists in prison following the early 1890s repression, and there was no real mobilization in their favors. He also saw the campaign as being too parliamentary in its orientation, and he was reticent because of that as well. But there has been quite a lot of, well, not quite a lot, but some historians have commented that what he resented was really not having ownership of that campaign. And so Sébastien Faure, alongside Bernard Lazare, was a key anarchist leader for the Dreyfus mobilization. And there are some pretty scathing letters exchanged between the two, where Faure chastises Grav for not joining in. And, you know, he wasn't that reluctant when the campaign was in his favor. And I think actually having read some of Grav's material on the Spanish campaigns, I think that actually he did like to lead his campaign. He could be quite uncompromising. He had a keen sense that the papers actually benefited from being involved in these campaigns. And that's why he was quite reticent, perhaps, to join a far, far broader mobilization like the Dreyfus Affair.
You see a similar phenomena, obviously different individual completely, but with the internationalization of the campaign, firstly for the release of Francisco Ferrer in 1909, and then the campaign kind of condemning his execution. You see similar moves from anarchists in Spain. Once the campaign leaves them and becomes more of a European, broadly left intellectual stance that centered Ferrer's educational work and not his anarchism or his syndicalism. You see a similar sort of reticence to kind of join in that, a similar, well, it's no longer our campaign. Why are we, you know, Ferrer wouldn't have wanted us to do this. He would want us to campaign for, as you say, anarchist prisoners still in jail and so on. And I think that's, there is an interesting and similar phenomena there. Bringing up Ferrer, you know, as you've mentioned their relationship already, that that's one of these key kind of international links between Ferrer, the educator in Spain, and Grave. This is a very personal hobby horse of mine, but I wondered, you mentioned in your article some of Grave's writings for children or of an explicitly educational purpose. And one of his most famous works, was really popular in Ferrer's school, was The Adventures of Nonno. And I just wondered if you'd kind of looked into that in any depth and if there's anything about that particular children's story that you'd like to talk about, because it's something I find fascinating.
It's a very interesting story. I've looked at his educationalism because there's actually quite a lot written about Grave. So I was quite conscious of not wanting to repeat too much of what had been written. And you might know that Mark Bray is writing, has just finished a book on the Ferrer and Spanish mobilization from a French and Spanish perspective. So I know this will come up then. It's already there in the Ferrer Reader. No, interesting work, really interesting work, and a completely different side of Grave. It really casts a very different light, and it was part of a broader set of children-oriented initiatives in the paper. So the paper, Le Temps Nouveau, printed all this art and sold all this art and recommended all these books, as all anarchist periodicals did. And in the 1890s and early 1900s, they started having a bibliographical section for children, Le Temps des Enfants, selling postcards for children, so extending this print propaganda towards children. And I've read some interesting correspondence, artistic correspondence. He had some artists illustrated it, but saying that it was difficult because it's a slightly clunky, allegorical book, and the artist complaining that it's really difficult, such a heavy allegory. So that's my main finding regarding Nonno. I thought it was quite funny because it's very true that he was a very clunky writer.
I think it's an amazing story. I mean, it's worth kind of looking up for anyone that's interested. It's a young boy who kind of wakes up in this world. The animals and plants talk to him, and it's this kind of amazing, fantastic world. And then he's whisked away to kind of capitalismus in Spanish. I don't know what it in French, and you know, it's awful. The review given of it by William Archer, who's a contemporary of Ferrer and wrote about his trial, is the words he used was laboriously allegorical. But I think that's fascinating. That I didn't know that the Les Temps Nouveaux had a whole section dedicated to children.
Yes, no, they had this whole section and initiatives towards children, and Grave's wife Mabel was involved in this also because she was an illustrator, so she collaborated to that section.
Yeah, there are some correspondences here with the life of Walter Crane, who is of a similar generation. I think he drew the frontispiece for Les Temps Nouveaux as well, and he was also, you know, he'd been friends with William Morris, involved in that kind of heterodox, not quite Marxist, not quite anarchist socialist milieu at the end of the 19th century in the UK, born in Liverpool, actually, as it happens. But he was also involved in like these educational activities as well. He illustrated the prospectus for the Louise Michel school that she set up in London, but he also like designed children's books as well, and was probably most famous in the end as being a children's book illustrator. He was also, you know, very high-minded in terms of ideology, but also of his time, and being probably one of the most famous artists in that period of anarchist and socialist activity. He also illustrated a map for an Imperial Reform League or something. It's like one of the most famous maps of the British Empire that shows Britannia sat on top of a globe. An interesting article written about this, you know, these like apparent contradiction in his life, but it seems like has broader resonances really for that whole period of socialist activism.
I was expecting when I started to find more connections with figures like Crane. The other one that springs to mind, not a another visual artist would be Carpenter, embeds a link with Carpenter through the Spanish or Hispanic mobilization that were very active in London throughout the 1890s. And Carpenter was involved in this, as he was in other episodes in Britain. So that sort of unorthodox socialism, as you say, is when I started looking at art specifically and artistic connections. And you would expect images to circulate more easily than texts. But having really considered it, in the case of Grave, I found that text actually circulated a lot more than images. The art, occasional exceptions like Crane's frontispiece or some material, visual material from Le Temps Nouveau being reprinted in Britain, but also in Prague. I just found it was very, very national, and I found that very counterintuitive. I don't know how it works for Spain, actually. I'd be interested hearing more.
It was striking. I noted in some anarchist articles about art and culture more broadly that there is very little tendency to problematize the national characteristics of culture in this period. You know, something that's kind of accepted as one of the positive values that culture can bring to any given society. And perhaps, you know, that is also reflected in the kind of uneven response of particularly older anarchists to jazz and the non-national musical forms that came out of the Black diaspora and obviously increased in popularity over the course of the 20th century.
They really liked all their didactic art. That's very characteristic, at least, of the genres and all the art that Grave was associated with or produced himself, plays, novels. Octave Mirbeau was their arch anarchist writer, the visual art. I think you're right that they were probably a lot less critical of the art as conveying nationalistic values or being genuinely avant-garde than they were of text. I think that would apply. But that's something to think about further, because there were all these critiques of art social, and Grave had arguments with some of his artistic contributors like Pissarro, Signac, and they did have arguments about that, about, you know, art or politics, which one at the edge. And
briefly follow up on that, I mean, in terms of artworks in Spanish periodicals at this time, there are actually surprisingly few at all publications that actually publish any art. And when they do, it generally is actually, in contrast to what you suggested, Constance, in France, they're often taken from German, French, British illustrators. There isn't a huge amount of Spanish illustrations. They're often the same ones that they would have printed 5 years ago, or taking one from another paper. So it's quite familiar for me to see illustrations in Les Temps Nouveaux, because often you'll get those in La Revista Blanca. But as you say, the main crossover is text in the Spanish case. Lots and lots and lots of French thinkers and writers translated into Spanish and appear there in that way. And I think it's actually something that's been relatively understudied. Whilst Spanish anarchism there is a greater emphasis on the transnational elements of it, often that is done almost still through a national framework in looking at Spanish migrants going to other places, particularly South America, and much less so about the actual exchanges that went on, particularly with France. Actually, I find it in the period, in the sort of turn of the century period, France is by so much the dominant influence on the Spanish movement in many ways, and not discussed an awful lot. And perhaps that's something that should be addressed. And I'm sure your book will help to do that, showing Grave's relationships extending out from his kind of base in Paris. You read a lot from Grave, from Kropotkin, that's been translated from French, because French is the language really that they have, the Spanish movement, much more so than any other.
I agree. I wanted to look at this as a test for diffusionist assumptions, as the jargon goes. So this idea of French anarchism being exported and imported all over the world. And I think you can't really bypass this kind of influence. The writings of Kropotkin and actually Grave and Reclus were really influential in many countries, as in the early days of local anarchist movements. So across Latin America, South Africa is another well-known case. The Chinese anarchists were really influenced by Kropotkin. So you can't really escape that diffusionist narrative, but I think you have to broaden the terms of the debate. So For instance, what I found with Grav is that there was a genuine openness and curiosity about other movements and a real desire to establish a genuine contact and have first-hand information. And I think that that does challenge hegemonic perceptions, or as you say, nationalistic readings, saying, okay, it is a somewhat unequal exchange, but they are very aware of this asymmetrical exchange and always trying to have a two-way exchange. And that was really important for Graf. So I was quite pleasantly surprised by this. I'm sure that's not the end of the argument, but I think that's an interesting way of looking at it. And another final element, I think, that could feed into this discussion is something that you note in your PhD, which is about original texts. We often think about all these translated texts, but as you point out, the material was often translated. There weren't original texts, but sometimes original texts were produced. And I think I haven't really paid attention to this until very recently. And I think that's a very important consideration to think, okay, all these texts, you know, translation, actually Max Nettlau was quite critical of this at some point. He could have been a contemporary historian criticizing transnationalism because he wrote to Graf saying, you know, it's all well and good selling your brochures and your pamphlets and your papers all over the world, but why is the French situation relevant all over the world? It's a very lazy assumption. And I think that's a very strong argument, again, that goes towards the fusionist argument. So, still quite a lot to consider there.
Since we're running out of time, I thought we'd better sort of wrap up the story in some ways. You mentioned right at the outset Graf's relationship with his wife, Mabel Holland-Thomas. So perhaps you could expand a little bit on the importance of that relationship to the story that you tell in your book.
Yes, I think it's really interesting to talk about emotions, and I will put it out there, romantic relationships of anarchism, probably a taboo. He married her. He got a lot of criticism for it because this was regarded as deeply conservative, especially by the individualistic anarchists with whom he had so many quarrels. And of course, she was of upper class extraction. I don't think anybody knew about the whole Napoleon III story. That would have caused them a lot of trouble. Sorry, actually, it's not Napoleon III, it's Louis-Napoleon Bonaparte, but still, one of the Bonaparte heirs. And Mabel, also, she helps feminize this very masculine or masculinist history. You know, and Graf can appear as a very conservative figure. He was reluctant towards the more innovative offshoots of anarchism, be it individualism, syndicalism, lifestyle experimentation. There's some really embarrassing passages on vegetarianism that he wrote. And she brings a completely different light to the story. So he had very few female contacts. There were very, very few female contributors to the paper. So even such a towering figure as Louise Michel is not really part of that story. I suspect he looked on her very unfavorably, even though he hasn't written anything. But Mabel, she wrote for the paper, she drew for the paper. She was a polymath, so she drew some beautiful illustrations, including for Nono, I think. She reported on Welsh labor for the paper. She helped him connect with a number of British activists, writers, artists by corresponding in English with them. So I think there's a lot there in feminizing the history, but also looking at emotions and the role of emotions and love in militancy. He was very, very sad when she died in 1929. Dedicated his memoir to her in a very moving way. So I think that's part of the story as well.
There's so many echoes here with Federico Rales that I should stop pointing them out, but I really think that there's something in how similar these stories sound and his own relationship with his wife, who very much brought that feminism edge to Rales' work.
There's definitely a comparative article on Grav and Rales waiting to be written there, so perhaps we can look at that.
In the light of what you were saying about the importance of emotion to this story, Grav's post-1918 trajectory. Is this a period of despair? Is this a period of personal defeat? How does he reflect on this experience and on his life more generally?
So he didn't budge much, and he was all his pre-war traits somehow aggravated or deteriorated his sense of being persecuted, of being right against everyone. So that's the first stage. And then he carried on by himself. I like these years. I think it's really interesting because it reads as an inverted image of this pre-war militancy. And he really tried to reactivate all his earlier strategies to reconnect. Let's use the paper as the basis to organize. Let's reach out. He was always extremely proactive in fundraising and trying to sell the paper. So he does all of this, but unsuccessfully. That's really interesting. I think it sheds a retrospective light on what he was doing before. But what he did, the last part, so he was quite old when he died, and there were several commemorative episodes. So very interesting correspondences with Max Nettlau on the question of nationalism and supporting a national emancipation struggles in Eastern Europe post-war, with Charles Malato doing the sort of post-mortem of the pre-war movement, and it's two old men discussing their failures and what they would have wished for themselves, for the movement. So Graf, for instance, regrets not speaking more in public because he was so shy, and he sees this as a real organizational failure on his part. He thinks it would have helped him engage more, fend off criticism of ivory power anarchism, which were a real theme for him. Then he publishes his memoir in 1930. Then in 1935, it's his 80th anniversary, and there's a big celebration and his honor thrown to him by the Ligue des Droits de l'Homme. So by that stage, he's completely reviled by the anarchist camp. But he has become a sort of Republican figure. That deserves many, many quotation marks. He has sort of, like the pre-1914 movement, he's been incorporated into a Republican historiography that has absorbed all the upheavals of 1890s terrorism. So there's a lot of memorialization and self-memorialization, and you can really try and link this with what effectively was the historiographic relegation of Grave until Jean Mitron wrote his History of the Movement in the 1970s, without being under any illusion regarding Grave. Mitron somehow rehabilitated Grave and restated how central he had been to the movement.
Before we wrap up, is there anything, Constance, that you'd like to mention that we haven't brought up?
No, not at all. I'm so grateful. It's so nice to be able to discuss something so specialized with such sympathetic interlocutors.
I really enjoyed it as well. So thank you.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed that episode. You can find links to Constance's full bibliography and an open access version of her article on Jean Grave in the notes for this episode. The podcast music is Stealing Orchestra, Gente de Miña Tierra. The podcast logo is an adapted version of the Left Book Club logo. And the image in this episode is a police mugshot of Jean Grave taken by Alphonse Bertillon in 1894, which is in the public domain. More details on all of these materials can be found in the notes. Love and solidarity. Until next time.
Senhor Secretário de Estado, faz favor de... Tenha bom. Tenha bom. Come on, come on, come on.